The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the seventh and final day of this seven-day session here at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico in March 2017. The sun has come out, the snow has melted. What comes next? 3 days ago, it was 60 degrees. The next day, we had a foot of snow everywhere. Life is change. How can we work with that? Today, I'd like to continue sharing some of the teachings of Kedo Fukushima, sometimes known as the old Buddha of Tofukuji. Tofukuji being one of the 14 headquarter temples of the Rinzai sect in Japan. Tofukuji is located in Kyoto, and Kedo Fukushima was, I don't know if there's a successor, but certainly he has at least one Westerner who is authorized to teach in his lineage, and that's Jeff Shore, who lives in Kyoto himself. The Rinzai sect has been known in general, not every Rinzai sect temple, unfortunately, but in general, the Rinzai sect, as compared to the Soto sect, is known for working with koans. And this is the main practice in the Rinzai sect, although it also begins and continues with the extended out-breath practice known as Sisokan. A very effective practice. The role of koans, beyond the breakthrough koan, are to expand and deepen our initial Kensho experience. And I'd like to share a little bit today from a book called Zen Bridge, Zen Teachings of Kedo Fukushima, that was compiled and edited by Grace and Peter Shireson, who were American students of Kedo Fukushima, and recorded all the encounters they had with him, or at least most of them, and vowed that one day they would make it available in English. One of the interesting things about Fukushima Roshi was that he was fluent in English. And he could do koan work with his American students, his English-speaking students, in English. In fact, he spoke to them saying it's not necessary to learn Japanese in order to train at Tofukuji. This is a little bit different from Morinaga Soko Roshi, who insisted that his students, and Morinaga Soko Roshi was also Rinzai Roshi, he insisted that all of his students had to learn Japanese. And there's a place in Zen for barriers. Zen practice is not easy. It demands a serious commitment. It's way too easy to get discouraged and quit. The three pillars of Zen are great faith. Faith that even though you're going blindly, you can still reach something most precious that you've lost contact with somehow. You can once more become one with it. And faith is essential in Zen practice because we are going blindly much of the time. And fortunately, we have the guidance, hopefully, of an authentic teacher. Great faith, great doubt is really, I would call it great perplexity. That means we question our assumptions about how things are. Is what society says really going to make us happy? That's a more superficial aspect of it. But beyond that, particularly as people get older, they begin to wonder about death and dying. What's it going to be like? and there's often a great deal of fear associated with it. And the last of the three pillars of Zen is great determination, because that's what it takes to continue our practice. Because as part of the practice, if it is a practice that is really bringing fruits, we will, over time, open to all the places, all the ways we are caught in delusion. The main delusion being an assumption that we are a particular kind of person. This is the tyrannical self-image out of which we act unwittingly, not always very skillfully, to buy into the assumption that the self-image is who we really are. We are then committed to upholding it, protecting it, and that results in reacting from it instead of responding to life. And this causes a great deal of pain and suffering. This particular chapter that I'd like to share with you today is called Enlightenment. And as a matter of fact, it's called Experiencing Enlightenment. Generally speaking, and Fukushima Roshi reiterates this, a Zen teacher doesn't advertise awakening, certainly not any experience of their own. But Fukushima Roshi here decides to share the experience of the initial awakening. And initial is important because awakening is not the end. It's a beginning. It's a significant beginning, but it's a beginning to truly living. So, in Japan, Zen masters never talk about what they experience regarding enlightenment, but in the West, where Zen is just beginning to take root, it's acceptable to do so. Although we still don't do it, really. Someone asked me about this a year ago, and I answered, personally, I don't really want to discuss the topic in terms of, hey, I got Satori. When you teach, you don't want to give off this kind of smell, the stink of Zen, that you're somehow great because you've attained enlightenment. And that is the thing. If we have a deep enough opening experience, we realize there's nothing special about it. It's, of course it's like that. It's only if we fall out of that experience that we realize how amazing it was. To be able to let go everything is to be given incredible freedom. We're no longer locked into having to react to life. We can respond, and suddenly all manner of options are available to us. And life is very much simpler. When you teach, you don't want to give off this kind of smell, the stink of Zen, that you're somehow great because you've attained enlightenment. I stress this emphatically to Westerners. There are many people in American Zen centers who say such things about themselves. In Japan, it's a tradition that Zen masters themselves never speak about their own enlightenment and their own positions. But it might be wise to actually explain this to Americans. So, as a special offering, I'll tell you about my master Shibayama Roshi's experience. Now, Shibayama Roshi, we know in the West because of his translation and commentary on the Mumonkan. Really, in my humble opinion, it's the best translation of the Mumonkan and the commentaries, and he also gives his own commentary on each of the koans. It's well worth studying, particularly once we start working on subsequent koans. Shibayama Roshi didn't mention his own experience until he was past the age of 70. No one asked him about it, and he spoke about it only once at a meeting for lay people. By chance, I was his attendant monk at the time. In the monastery, no one would talk about such a thing. So this was the first time I heard such a story. He had had his first major experience, and I emphasize again, his first major experience, during a Rojas Sesshin, the most intensive retreat week of the year, in his third year of training as a monk. And in the Tofukuji lineage, all 7 days of the Rohatsu Sesshin, actually 8 days, because it ends the morning of the eighth day, just as with the Buddha awakening on seeing the morning star on the eighth day of his own really first Sesshin ever. No one goes to sleep. No one goes to bed. The day is one long 8 days worth of day. And Fukushima Roshi writes elsewhere that when he first heard of this, he thought it was crazy. But then as he took part in these Rohatsu Sesshins year after year, he began to realize there was some benefit to this, that it brings you to a place where you really can't hold on to your usual stuff. And that is one of its benefits. At Sogenji, we weren't quite as extreme as staying up all night, every night of Rohatsu Sesshin. But the last 2 nights of Sesshin, there were only 2 hours set aside for the possibility of a rest or sleep. And during those 2 hours, you were allowed to bring a blanket into the zendo, and of course, nobody slept in the zendo, but you could wrap it around you because it was quite cold, and there was no real heat in the zendo. It being early December in Japan, a very, very cold time of the year, particularly when you've already been cold and colder and colder, and then, of course, it gets even colder. But the first year I was there, I took advantage of the 2 hours to take a nap, and after that I did not do that because it was actually quite a bit easier to stay up all night the last 2 nights than it was to get 2 hours of sleep. It kind of wreaked havoc with your biorhythms. There's a lot to be said about doing all-night yaza. And in my early years of training, I did at least one all-nighter, as well as many other hours of yaza every single night of Sesshin. And it made a difference, I think, in my practice. There was, however, one Sesshin where I tried doing all night sitting 3 nights in a row, not in a row, but every other night for 3 nights. And that left me a blithering idiot. And I went into Doksan the last morning and the Roshi looked at me and said, "Go to bed." Our bodies vary. There's no one size fits all. But the main point, really, in Zen practice is if we're not going to push the envelope in some way, we're not going to reach awakening. Because awakening is to step outside of yourself. And in fact, in another part of this book, he has a comment. "Gaining Satori and experiencing Mu means that for a brief moment one spiritually dies. This is called the Great Death. This fact of losing oneself is very important. While spiritually becoming Mu, which means no thing, or actually Mu literally means no or not, means undergoing a kind of death, there's also a return or a revival, and that's essential. You cannot have gone into the experience of nothing and call that enlightenment. It isn't complete until you come out the other side. So you know both sides. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. While spiritually becoming Wu means undergoing a kind of death, there is also a return or a revival. You could say that when you die, you live. But this is something you have to experience for yourself. With a personal experience of Mu, a new self is born. Or we might also say the original self is uncovered. Without this kind of death and rebirth, Zen would be a dead religion. So continuing with Shibayama Roshi's experience. To put the experience simply, we could say it's an experience in which you become Mu. And of course, the background of this Mu is a koan in which a monk has asked the great Zen master, Chinese Zen master Joshu, does even a dog have the Buddha nature? Because in those days in China, dogs were the bottom of the barrel in terms of despicable characters. So, you know, Buddha nature, of course, is this amazing thing, right? And some dirty creature couldn't possibly have it, could they? And Joshu answered, Mu, meaning no or not. And the interesting thing is that another time, another monk asked him the same question. And this time he said, Wu, which meant yes. And to put a real conundrum before us, both answers are correct. A dog and you and me and all things have the Buddha nature and don't have the Buddha nature. A better way to put it is, are the Buddha nature and are not the Buddha nature. So how can something be and not be at the same time? This is the core of this puzzle. To put the experience simply, we could say it's an experience in which you become Mu and you understand intimately what that means. You don't disappear physically and become nothing. Rather, while you are alive, you realize you are no thing. Just before you have this experience, without fail, some kind of illusion arises. Or it might not. I don't know if I would say that's absolutely the truth. It may have been Fukushima Roshi's observation and experience himself, but I'm not sure it's true for everybody. And for each individual, the particular illusion is different. Shibayama Roshi was sitting Zazen. Nearby, there was another temple that would ring a large bell at 8 o'clock each evening. Shibayama Roshi heard the sound and thought, ah, the bell's ringing. When you sit Zazen, your eyes are half open and half shut. When Shibayama Roshi heard the gong, he said it was as though the sound waves turned into a gold thread, which he could see before his eyes. He thought this was strange. And here we are with the Makyo. And it can be common that one goes through a period of experiencing Makyo, which can be translated as devilish phenomena, before one does go deeply enough, or as part of the process of one going deeply enough, that one eventually has a Kensho experience. Kensho meaning seeing into. And what we're seeing into is the nature of reality. The bell rang again, and again he could see the wave. He thought maybe he'd lost something. So he opened his eyes and looked across the Zendo and saw the other monks in Zazen. He felt he shouldn't let something so insignificant disturb him. This is a real testament to his commitment to practice. So he lowered his eyes to resume Zazen. At this point, the golden thread disappeared, but it was followed by another illusion. One day on begging rounds, on Takohatsu, Shibayama Roshi saw a parent and a child begging. They were extremely dirty. These days, you don't see such things in Japan, but when Shibayama Roshi was training in Kyoto, you would sometimes see such beggars. It may have been immediately post-war, when there were a lot of people who were pretty destitute in Japan. He thought that, among all the beggars he'd ever seen, never had he seen begging as dirty as this pair. He thought they were so dirty that they were Zen masters of begging. It's an interesting response. This was how desperate they were. They made a very strong impression on him, and this is what came to him as an illusion during his Zazen. But in the illusion, the beggars were wearing clothes of gold. Shri Yamarushi thought he'd gone a little bonkers. Then he thought, even if he went crazy, he would continue. You can see he was practicing at a very high level. I was moved when I heard this story. Shiva Yamarushi sat like that through the night. And the next morning, he forgot which day of the week it was. Having been without sleep, as is customary during Rohatsu Sesshin, the monastery was surrounded by woods, so when dawn came, all the birds began singing together. Sitting at dawn, you can feel this. The birds are sparrows. Shiva Yamarushi, convinced he might have lost his mind, heard the birds, and he thought, ah, the birds are singing. But he realized there is no self that listens. He realized that there was no self that listens. This is the core of an awakening experience. For those who truly understand Zen, we can say it is the no self that hears the sparrows. That morning they served tea. When he drank it, he thought, ah, this tea is very good. But he also realized it is the no self that drinks the tea. He had the experience of the no self drinking. This is the experience of becoming mu or nothing. And it's impossible to describe. We're not sitting there thinking, oh, this is the no self that's drinking. It's an experience of drinking and without the usual self-image before our face or driving our perception. After this, Shiva Yamarushi went to Zen question and answer, which really is Sanzen. His master looked at him and could see Shiva Yamarushi had had a deep experience. But one must not make a mistake. This is just a first experience. In terms of koan study, Shiva Yamarushi had just done a little bit. He still had 2,000 questions left to answer. And through the study of these koans, you deepen your understanding. This is something misunderstood in America. Many people believe that when you have just this first experience, that's it. That's the great Satori enlightenment experience. Of course, there's a great difference between whether you have had such an experience or not. But you have to deepen this experience up until the time of your death. And I quote Hakuin here, who said that he had 19 major Kensho experiences and countless minor ones. Yes, a Kensho experience is a vital aspect of Zen. It's very important because it's a kind of a watershed, really. We're able to see and deepen in a different way. We're more free after we've had a Kensho experience. But we can't let that go to our head, as it does sometimes for people. We have to drop it and keep practicing over and over and over again. One of the things that impressed me most about Kapla Roshi was that he never stopped practicing. I was his attendant and secretary many different times as he grew older. And this was my observation. It's something to emulate for both of us, for all of us, really. And now I'd like to share with you some poetry that points towards awakened mind states. This is from a book called The Enlightened Heart, an anthology of sacred poetry edited by Stephen Mitchell. This is Layman Pong. When the mind is at peace, the world too is at peace. Nothing real, nothing absent. Not holding on to reality, not getting stuck in the void. You are neither holy nor wise, just an ordinary fellow who's completed his work. And he underscores this with this poem. My daily affairs are quite ordinary. I'm in total harmony with them. I don't hold on to anything, don't reject anything. Nowhere an obstacle or conflict. Who cares about wealth and honor? Even the poorest thing shines. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, drawing water and carrying wood. It's important to realize that this freedom isn't a mind state where we just don't care about things. This is a mind state where we're clear in our response to life. So, if the political situation is troubled, as it seems to be these days in the United States, if it is our karmic destiny to respond and to be active, that's what we do. But how we do it depends on whether or not we are let go enough that we're not doing it from the standpoint of an egotistical stance. When we are able to do things from this place of having let go enough, then it's very different. And not only that, but it's almost as if the friction and the obstacles dissolve. We can see clearly how to move forward with whatever we're moved to do. And that is quite important. This is Rumi. Totally conscious and apropos of nothing, he comes to see me. Is someone here, I ask? The moon. The full moon is inside your house. My friends and I go running out into the street. I'm in here, comes a voice from the house, but we aren't listening. We're looking up at the sky. My pet nightingale sobs like a drunk in the garden. Ring doves scattered with small cries. Where? Where? It's midnight. The whole neighborhood is up and out in the street thinking the cat burglars come back. The actual thief is there too, saying out loud, oh yes, the cat burglar's somewhere in this crowd. But no one pays attention. Lo, I am with you always means when you look for God, God is in the look of your eyes, in the thought of looking, nearer to you than your own self. Or things that have happened to you. There's no need to go outside. Be melting snow. Wash yourself of yourself. A white flower grows in the quietness. Let your tongue become that flower. Ryokan, Japanese monk. In all the 10 directions of the universe, there's only one truth. When we see clearly, the great teachings are the same. What can ever be lost? What can be attained? If we attain something, it was there from the beginning of time. If we lose something, it's hiding somewhere near us. Look, this ball in my pocket. Can you see how priceless it is? This awakened mind is not something we have to get. It is us. It's a matter of uncovering it. And this is why Zen practice can be so challenging. Because in the process of uncovering that true nature, as I said at the beginning, we are faced with all the ways we're caught in hiding it. In these last hours of this session, as you've heard so many times, the potential is huge because of all the work you've done in the days and hours arriving at this point. Give yourself so completely that you forget yourself. And then you can become awakened by the 10,000 things, as Dogen has promised. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.